Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for
really,
thousands
it
more.
It is the Cool Kids Club. Big money.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here celebrating my fourth anniversary on the station of the food scene, and couldn't think of a better person to do that with. But my good friend, Jamie Bissonette, recent James Beard Foundation Award winner, Best Chef Northeast. You can give your acceptance speech now, if you'd like.
I don't know, I'm having a hard time concentrating. Yeah. It's a lot of eye contact we just made.
Yeah, no, I know, staring deep into your soul. Now I know everything about you, so these notes are completely moot. First of all, congratulations again. I couldn't be happy for you. You know, like, I've known you for over a decade, I think, from time in Boston. Now, you know, you coming to New York, opening up Toro, and seeing how those two cities don't really define you. You know, even though you live in them and you're a proprietor, what you've done with your cuisine over time and taken elements of all your interests, and I hate using the word fusion, is very much like Bad Brains.
I like it.
Yeah. So let's talk about your childhood growing up in the thoroughfare of Connecticut.
Yeah. Grew up just outside of Hartford, Connecticut, a little town called Canton, even a smaller, like, micro town within it called Collinsville, but they were just part of the same place. And fell into a bunch of different music scenes and got really into music with, you know, from my father, who's a jazz musician, and I started to really appreciate all different kinds of music. You know, as a kid, I loved, you know, the first Van Halen record came out, I had to get it, and I loved Michael Jackson and, like, wanted to learn how to moonwalk and just loved the energy of, like, that kind of, like, dynamic pop sound, but didn't identify to it and just felt different. And it wasn't until I was in early teens that somebody played me, like, a Misfits record and a Metallica record, and I was like, yeah, this is different. This isn't what everybody else likes.
Yeah, we were just talking about Ian McKay before because I loved Misfits, still love them, and Fugazi. And it's just, you know, a different meter too. You know, it's almost kind of like being in the kitchen in a sense. You know, there's that pulse, that energy, and that strength. You know,
100%. Like, for me, like, the ultimate way to describe what a kitchen is like is like that. You know, Bad Brains' first song where it just starts. It's like thump 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 thump
thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump thump would be amazing.
Sounds good to me.
But, you know, I make that Bad Brains reference because you could explain it a little bit more. The first album I ever heard of them was Eye Against Eye, and it was inflected with reggae because I guess they had seen Bob Marley and, you know, loved not only the performance, but we're starting getting into, you know, Rastafarian culture.
Well, they were like that from the get-go. Even Black Dots, their first records, they always had that underlying tone. They started off as, you know, playing jazz and blues and got into, you know, seeing, you know, I don't know their whole story perfectly, but seeing punk and getting into punk in like the late 70s and having Black Dots come out, they looked mod. They were wearing tight black suits and white shirts and black ties, and they were dancing around like if the Beatles and the Who were hopped up on something. And they were just, you know, they were like punk rock. They were more than punk rock. They were hardcore. And they were I Rastafari Jah guys. And they played, you know, they were really famous for playing hard, fast, like speed metal punk than going right into like a ballady kind of, you know, reggae song or ska song. And it was just, they were the first to bridge that, like the pre-Fishbone, pre-Murphy's Law band that just made that kind of sound happen.
So were you punk rock? Were you hardcore? Were you straight edge? Vegan?
Man. What's that song? I was a hippie. I was a surfer. I was so drugged out. I was out of my head. No, I was a hardcore kid. Yeah, I was straight edge. I was punk. I identified more with hardcore than punk, you know, more of like Youth of Today, Gorilla Biscuits, Bad Brains than the, you know, other things. But I always loved the history of like Minor Threat. I mean, you can't go, you know, far into punk or hardcore without hearing Ian McKay's vocals just screaming something. But yeah, I was vegan for years, straight edge until I was in my early 20s, vegan till the same. And it taught me a lot about discipline and just being, you know, knowing what you believe in.
You know, you say discipline, and maybe we'll talk about a chef's kill mode later. But, you know, discipline and restraint are two very similar things. Your career path, was it tended towards music and chaos, or where did you find the culinary arts?
Wow. You know, I get asked that question a lot, and every time I contemplate, I look back and just say, dumb fucking luck. That's all it was. I played in bands, and like we would leave school early and had jobs because we were the kids. You know, that like that section of school where they say, oh, those kids aren't going to go to college, so we're going to let them do a work-study program where they get to leave at lunch and go get real jobs because they need to start earning their minimum wage now because they're going to be doing that for the next 20 years.
Yep.
Yeah, that was me. So doing that gave me the freedom to work a job. I worked at a grocery store in the deli, worked as a cashier, bounced around doing that, and also gave me the free time to have a band. And, you know, we had a hardcore band called Justify, real terrible, terrible band, really bad. And we would, you know, rock out in Andy Ardensky's basement and talk about what we were going to have for lunch. And no matter what it was, afterwards it was, are we going to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken and get the vegan potatoes? Or are we going to go to the diner and get French fries? Like, it was always about food. And I found that I was always concentrating about, hey, can I make lunch for the band? Like, what? And I stopped learning the music, and, you know, eventually I got kicked out of the band.
for being a lunch maid.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I was a lunch lady.
Yeah, I mean, so what did you try to make for the band? Because, you know, veganism was really ingrained in punk culture, so much so that there were, like, cookbooks circulating through the punk and, you know, hardcore community, because there wasn't that reference out there.
Oh, I mean, for sure. Just being, saying in, you know, 1992, 1993, I'm a vegetarian, and you're not a hippie. It was like, well, what the fuck is wrong with you, man? And, you know, like, oh, well, you know, these hippie kids are smoking pot. They just don't want it. I'm like, no, we're straight edge. Like, we don't do any drugs. Our drug was adrenaline. We wanted to do things, you know, we wanted to do things like go to the dump and buy broken couches and screw skis on the bottom of them and bring them to the top of a hill and go down and like sledding in the snow and destroy things. Like, we wanted to do flips into people's yards and break their bushes, not to be destructive, but because we all had this pent up energy. And as, you know, a young punk rock kid and not playing in bands and playing in bands, going to shows and jumping off stages and doing flips and touring as a roadie, and like a band would come to town and say, does anybody want to come with us? Like, yeah, dude, I'll come. Call my parents. I'm like, hey, I'm going to go see this band tonight in New Haven, Connecticut. And then I call them the next night. I'm like, hey, I'm in Pittsburgh, and we're heading to Ohio. I'll be back in like a week. Like, you're in school, and you're 15. I'm like, yeah, totally cool. Don't worry about it. And, you know, eventually I got kicked out of the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was always cooking. And then I eventually got kicked out of school and got GED and looked around and said, I need to get as far away from Hartford, Connecticut as I can.
I was trying to figure out why Florida. Why Fort Lauderdale?
You know, so I was in one of those schools for the kids that always fuck up. And the class, they came and did a hey, this is a college that accepts artist types. You don't have to be a straight-A student. We don't care about your GPA. Like, yeah, well, they just care about money. And then I looked, and it's like, wasn't that expensive. They were really helpful with getting student loans, and they had graphic arts, computer animation. I didn't even have an email. I had never really used a computer. My typing classes were still on typewriters in school. Like, this is like a really high-tech school and coming to a really low-tech part of the world. And they had a culinary department. And I was like, you know what? I really like working at this grocery store and working with the food that I do. And I like the way the squeegee looks on the floor when they're mopping up. I like that they make a mess and then clean it up. I love the stainless steel. I love the clanging and banging of things. It just reminded me of like loading into drums into a show. And I said, well, if they can accept me, I'm going to go. And they did. So I went.
Well, I mean, let's talk about family life a little bit before, because you had your vegan, you know, cooking abilities. But I've read that your mother was known for chili and chicken wings.
Those are the two things that I can remember fondly. But she was known for making a lot of things. She was one year we were having shish kebab, and my friend came over. He's like, "Your mom makes shish kebab weird." I'm like, "Why?" She just opened up beef stew out of it, like an oval Dinty Moore thing, and put it on skewers. I was like, "Yeah, I didn't know potatoes were an actual vegetable or a root vegetable. I thought they came out of a powder in a box or they came frozen." Like, there's, you know, late 70s, early 80s cooking. There wasn't a lot of farm to table going on.
Yeah. So, I mean, what was eye opening at the Art Institute?
Just getting away and seeing new things, and like being, you know, my first day having somebody say, "You need to learn how to hold a knife." And I was like, "Okay." And you need to learn how to taste, and you need to learn how to be clean, and you need to learn discipline. And I was kind of like, "Where have you been all my life?" It was like romance. I fell in love with the energy in a kitchen of, you know, coming into a spotless area, creating something, making something delicious. The smells, the aromas, just like feeding somebody, seeing that instant gratification, instant satisfaction of seeing how they react to it. And then the breakdown afterwards of cleaning and polishing and, you know, keeping your knife sharp. It's like being a chef with a dull knife is like being a musician with an out-of-tune guitar. It's just, you can't do it properly.
So, I mean, where did all that adrenaline go? Obviously, it was refocusing the food, but how did you create a discipline for yourself when there wasn't that much before?
I had a little bit of help from the authorities.
Shout out to the authorities.
ACAB, but they did really help me. I got arrested a lot, got in a lot of trouble for fighting and just doing dumb shit and being a kid. And I went to culinary school at 17 years old. I was a child. I wasn't legally allowed to use the slicer until my second semester, because in Florida you're not allowed to use heavy machinery, and a slicer was technically heavy machinery, you know? And then I, you know, graduated school and was still part of the, I mean, I always stayed part of the punk rock hardcore scene, touring with bands and going to see things. And after that, I decided I wanted to really take my craft seriously, and I left Florida and went to Boston. I literally decided on Friday, packed up my stuff, got in my car, my Ford Escort LX 1989 hatchback, and drove straight from Fort Lauderdale to Boston. Lived with my uncle for a couple months, worked at a couple restaurants, and then decided that Boston wasn't for me at that time. Went back to Connecticut, and then bounced around, did some time in Phoenix, just traveled, and then found myself back in Connecticut in like late 90s. And wasn't really doing much there, working at the best restaurants they had and learning a ton. But I turned into a townie. At that point, I learned how to cook pretty well and learned how to drink really well and really honed my skills of being a dick at a bar. And one day I just had a realization that if I stayed in Hartford, I was going to go down the path that everybody growing up thought I was going to go down, which was being a loser, going to jail, and being, you know, uncreative, and just uninspiring. And I moved to Boston to work at Clio with Ken Oringer, and didn't end up staying there. Bounced around, and here we are 14 years later. Ken's my business partner. We've got three restaurants together, and somebody put a medal around my neck a couple weeks ago.
Somebody. Weird. Yeah. It's a crazy life. Well, on that, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about being a masshole. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Seeing a need to help people sort through all the misinformation about healthy eating, Whole Foods Market added a seventh core value: to promote the health of our stakeholders through healthy eating education. In our stores, we give you the tools you need for choosing the most nutritious foods and healthy recipes, as well as offering classes with nutritionists and cooking coaches to help inspire good health and well-being. Stop by your local store today and learn more about our Health Starts Here program and wellness clubs, or online at wholefoodsmarket.com/healthstartshere.
everybody, and welcome back to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here today with Jamie Bissonnette. I said masshole. I mean that as affectionately as I can, because I went to school and lived in Boston for years, and you know, I'll say it now. I'm a Red Sox fan. You know, I'm a New Yorker. I'm a Red Sox fan because there's something about that city that changed me, and I don't know if it's a similar thing, but
100%. I grew up in Connecticut, and it was like 50-50. My uncle loved the Red Sox. My best friend was from the Bronx. I became a Yankees fan. I had everything Mr. Baseball, Don Mattingly, Ricky Henderson. I knew every item of everything going on from the like 78 to probably 89 Yankees team. I went to more games at the old Yankee Stadium than anywhere else. And I moved to Boston and I would wear a Yankees hat. And I was there for about 6 years, like, yep, I'm a Yankees fan. And then we opened up Eastern Standard, which is right by the Fenway Park. And I would wear my Yankees hat. Like, oh, you're just doing that to be a jerk. I'm like, nope, I'm a Yankees fan. That's what I am. I'm a Yankees fan. And then a couple years later, I was friends, became friends with, a you know, passive friends with Kevin Youkilis, who was on the Sox at the time. And he goes, dude, you're not a Yankees fan. What are you talking about? He's like, you're a baseball fan. You love baseball. You talk about it all the time, and you come to the Red Sox games, and you root for the Red Sox unless they're playing the Yankees. He's like, you're just a baseball fan, and you should embrace the city that you're a part of. And I was like, yeah, I guess you're right. And, you know, I was traveling a lot that summer and then that fall. And everywhere I went, people were like, oh, you're from Boston. Oh, Boston. And I was like, you know what? I'm wearing a Yankees hat. I'm from Boston, and people keep asking me about the Yankees. I can't even tell, like, two players right now. And a couple years later, somebody gave me a Red Sox hat. I put it on, and I looked around. I was like, I don't know if I'm a Red Sox fan so much as I'm just a Boston fan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what I say. I'm a Bruins fan because the Whalers are gone. I've never really been a big basketball fan. I've always liked the Patriots. And as far as baseball goes, I definitely root for the Red Sox now.
You almost tripped up. I heard that. The Yankees almost came out. But you root for Boston, and that's what's so important. You know, what Boston is that a lot of other cities that I've been in haven't been, at least for me, is it's got this camaraderie, this sense of, you know, support, the system within that isn't as cutthroat. And I know it's a challenging career being a chef or anything creatively for that matter. But there was always such solid people there. And I was lucky enough to have Ken Oringer as a mentor for 3 years as well. And the profound effect that he's had on me is not lost. But what was it about, you know, working at Eastern Standard, Clio, KO Prime, that was different than your other culinary ventures?
Well, coming to Boston, just having grown up going to see bands play there, I felt like I knew the city in a different way. You know, people like, oh, we're going to go to Kenmore Square. That meant the Deli House and the Rat and IHOP, which
House.
Now means Eastern Standard, Island Creek Oyster Bar, and Lower Depths. Three really good restaurants in the industry that back then to me were go mosh, go fight, go eat. Like that's what it meant. And, you know, being like, hey, we're going to go to the Channel and go see Quicksand and Burn. And now going to that same area means I'm going to see Louis de Beccari at Tavern Road and Barbara at Sportello. It's different for me. Like I've always felt each neighborhood spoke to me in a different way. And going up there, having the friends that I had, people that I'd known since I was 13 years old, just from punk shows. And, like, the hardcore community is its own subculture. You know, the punk scene is its own subculture. Very, very supportive, not unlike the cooking scene in Boston where everybody wants to help each other. You know, there's not a lot of sabotage going on. Not that there is in other cities, but Boston specifically, when you're in Boston and you're coming up in Boston and you go from being the prep cook to the line cook and the line cook to the sous chef and whatnot, people are there for you. You have a safety net of people that really care, and they don't care just about you. They care about their city. Like, great people rise to support other great people in Boston, and that's what I love about it.
Let's talk about Toro, because you were at KO Prime. Ken Oringer approached you, and this concept was born. How did you two join forces, collaborate, and, you know, create this phenomenon?
You mean Toro?
Yep.
Well, so I was at Eastern Standard and ready to leave, and I was the executive chef at a restaurant that was doing great. I was having fun. I was making the most money I'd ever made, but I just said, you know, I said to my friends, I said, I want to learn more. I want to learn, and I want to learn more from Ken. And I was going to approach him, And I didn't, because I didn't like him at the time. I didn't dislike him, but I just didn't know him enough. He just seemed something about him. I just was like, I don't want to tell him I look up to him. Like, he's going to use that against me. And then about a week later, I got a call out of the blue. I'll never forget it, because I was putting out an electrical fire that I had accidentally started by trying to... I took a plug for something that didn't fit in the wall, and I bent it with pliers so it would fit, because that's real smart. 45 minutes later, the whole wall, interior wall's on fire in the hotel. Got in a little bit of trouble for that. But I remember watching that fire blaze, and the fire department comes in, and my cell phone rings, and it's Ken. He's like, hey, can you meet for coffee? I want to talk to you.
This is like the greatest Phoenixology of all time. Like, talk all the allegories that have been going on from, you know, hardcore to sports to just keep going. This is your show now.
Burn it down. So I went and met Ken for coffee, and he's like, hey, I'm taking over this concept where this restaurant Spire was, and we're going to do a steakhouse there. It's a hotel, breakfast, lunch, and dinner banquets. You know, I know you're really good with hotels. You're a really great cook. I've loved your food since you were at Pigalle. I've loved, you know, watching you grow in the city.
Can we just shout out Mark Orfley for a second?
Mark Orfley's the best.
Yeah, not many people know him in New York, but man, what a fixture.
He's crazy as a shithouse rat in all the right ways.
Yeah.
And my first day working with Mark Orfley, we had to, Fish was playing down the street, and some hippie kid stumbled in and was walking around the dining room, like, totally blazed out of his mind. We couldn't get the kid to leave, and Mark and I had to bring him outside. He started resisting. We opened up the door with the kid's head and, like, threw him out like a log. I was like, yep, I'm going to like working with this guy. Yeah. It's okay. Ken approached me, asked me if I wanted to you know, interview for this job. I met with the people, interviewed, worked there for about a year and a half, and you know, I said, I want more. I don't want to be in a hotel restaurant anymore. I want to go back to something small. I want to not do steakhouse. I want to, I know I'm young. I was just turning 30. I wanted to do something else. And I said, for my birthday, my gift to myself was giving my notice. And I called him and said, hey, I want to give my notice. And without even skipping a beat on the phone, he goes, Toro had been open for about a year and a half. And he goes, cool. How about if I make you my business partner at Toro, you take over Toro and we start doing other restaurants together? And I went, wait, I wasn't ready for that. I thought I was moving. And I said, yeah, let me think about it. And we met a couple days later. And slowly I took over Toro, and the rest has been a blur.
Spanish tapas. I mean, was this something you were familiar with?
Oh, yeah. From traveling, I'd always been in love with Spanish tapas. And I love that, you know, going to Toro before Ken and I became business partners there, it was like my favorite restaurant, because it was like build your own tasting menu in whatever speed you want. You want it to be rapid fire, and you want 14 courses done in 10 minutes? No problem. Order it all at once. You want to do 14 courses over the course of 5 hours? Order one or two things at a time. You could build it your own way. And it was like the thought of taking great cooking, great ingredients, and putting them in small plates the way that Toro did at the time and still continues to do now was something that we didn't see a lot of. You know, a lot of the tapas restaurants that you would go to were always middle of the road level. People weren't putting the energy into the food. And with Toro, Ken was. And then when we took it over together, we just kind of said, what's missing and what do we want to do here? And, you know, we just threw all of our ideas against the wall, pulled it off, and that was the menu, and the rest has been like a honeymoon.
I can't wait for Ken to listen to this episode. But, you know, pan con tomate, paella, these staples were already on the menu. So what did you personally bring? How did you change Toro? And then I'm going to segue right into Copa, too, because it's like the Italian version of Toro, in a sense.
I mean, it's hard to say. I don't like to talk about myself and what I've done. But what we did with that restaurant was I had people that had been following me from Eastern Standard to KO Prime that were like, hey, Jamie's the only dude making really delicious pig brains and tripe and, you know, like lots of offal. Not the only one, but people found it in an approachable way because I was doing it where it wasn't expensive and I was doing it in a more casual environment. And one of the things we did with Toro was bring a lot of that stuff there, really pushing the envelope with offal and then whole animals and then saying, hey, let's make this food. I mean, I think it's really popular now to say that, like, oh, that menu's really cool. It's like stoner chic food. As you know, that's kind of what we went for. But I went for, like, what's the kind of stuff that, like, if, you know, you're a little bit baked, what do you think's going to be great? And, you know, what do I want to eat? What do line cooks want to eat? How do we make it affordable so restaurant people come to the restaurant? And, you know, I don't think anything was intentional, but we did all these things. And
I mean, more Sia, blood sausage. What are the veal sweetbreads called?
Mollejas.
Mollejas. What else do we have? I mean, it, again, with the offal, it was what a lot of chefs didn't. They didn't even know they wanted to eat it then, but they know they wanted to try it, you know, because there wasn't even that. I was reading about how when you worked in Phoenix, you would go out on Sundays for menudo, you know, and you started falling in love with tripe. And at one point in your career, you cooked tripe and people are like, oh, this is better than my grandma's. Like, this is outstanding. But realizing you can manipulate those organs, you know.
Well, I always say, you know, being a chef is being a teacher. And anybody can teach anybody how to fry an egg properly. It's the most simple thing, and most cooks don't really learn it, but anybody can learn that. I could teach anybody how to roast a chicken. I could teach anybody how to do trout almondine. If you look at what all the most popular cookbooks over the last 20 years are, you're going to find common things of simple, straightforward cooking. And it's so important. It's so important for people to master that. And as a chef, I wanted to teach people something more. I wanted to teach cooks something different. And learning how to take something that inherently smells terrible, is tough, hard to cook, and transforming it into something that people say, this is delicious, you know, something like tripe or blood or feet or ears. That's, I think that takes a little bit more effort, and it's kind of more fun for me.
I mean, it's in the same vein as your fascination with charcuterie. Can we give a shout out to your book too, coming out this summer? I'm August, so excited to
August
check 26th, it out.
August 26th, hopefully. Yeah, you can still pre-order it on Amazon. It makes me look really good for my publisher.
But charcuterie is like an old school idea. And what you've done with charcuterie, these newer concepts, using different cuts, adding different blends of spices, and, you know, this pushes the envelope too. Have you seen people accept that at Copa in a way that you didn't expect?
When we looked at the space for Copa and we decided that we were going to open up there, you know, I said, I want to do a lot of charcuterie. And we started off doing straightforward things, and we just had guests asking for more. And then as I traveled and tried things, I was like, you know, a lot of people are doing really awesome nuja. A lot of people are doing really simple salamis that are great. And I was like, well, what do I want to do that's different? And I found that when I was in Southeast Asia, having those kind of flavors were unique. I got to cook a dinner with Marcus Samuelson at Copa, and he introduced me to berber spice. And I was like, holy cow. It's to the point now where I'm actually not allowed to use it anymore. All my sous chefs are like, all right, staff meal's starting to always taste the same. Every time Jamie makes it, he reaches for the berber spice. And, you know, it's just great. I love flavor, and I don't really care how it gets into a dish as long as it gets there, and at the end you taste it and go, man, that's great. And like to taste something and go, what's that flavor? What is that makes it different? And somebody's like, oh, it's lime zest. It's like, oh, why didn't I think to do that? And traveling and asking questions when I eat at my friends' restaurants, I always said, you know, little things like that that I learned from them just from eating their food is what I tried to put into my food.
Well, I also know that in the book, you have a Lebanese lamb sausage recipe, and you didn't have to travel too far to get those kind of flavors and ingredients, because where you're located in the South End, you know, right next to Formaggio Kitchen, is another store that carries all that stuff. And I ate at Copa, and you had this dish. It was fregola and burrata and harissa, am I right? And it was so interesting, because I saw so much of your past and so much of your future kind of like separated by this rift of grain. Like it was like so emblematic of who you are and who you were as a cook, and, you know, that area of the South End.
Man, you're making my food look really thought out. That's great.
But I mean, you went across the street, and what did that shop? What is that shop called, by the way? It's like one of those where you walk
South End Food Emporium. That one. Or the Lebanese market?
Lebanese market.
It's called the Lebanese market.
Yeah.
But you walk. They keep very odd hours. They open whenever the hell they want, and they close whenever they're ready.
Yeah. But, I mean, you started inflecting your food with those ingredients.
Well, it was that, and it was also our landlord at Toro in Boston is Jay Hosh. He's from Beirut, and he owns Mike City Diner as well. He was doing a Lebanese meze dinner, guest chef dinner once a year with us, and his food was so fucking good, craveably delicious. And he told me that some of the spices that I could get there, and then the lamb sausage recipe in my book is me trying to replicate his recipes. And even I say in the introduction to the recipe, said, this is my version of what Jay makes. It's not as good as his because he won't give me the recipe.
But can you define yourself anymore? I know Copa's Anateca. I know Toro is Spanish tapas. But where's your food in the world now?
I don't know.
I mean, it's so exciting. I'm not saying that as a lost soul again.
I want to quote Sick of It All and say, no labels, no lies, no bullshit to hide behind. You know, I don't think I need to have a label. I just like to cook good food and make people happy and smile. It doesn't matter if somebody says it's Korean or if somebody says it's Low Asian or somebody says it's Jamaican. I don't care.
People say it's Boston Toro versus New York Toro? Because I think now you have a really interesting situation where you have these two establishments in two different cities, as different as the Red Sox and the Yankees. How do you cook for each clientele, each crowd? How do they differ?
We've got more variety in New York just because, A, we have a bigger restaurant. We have more space to flex our wings and do more. And we've got more people coming in, so we can do more different things because of the dichotomy of guest. But, you know, having the two restaurants, people who've been to Boston, they come to New York, and it's like that scene in Wayne's World. They walk in, and they look around, and they go, it looks like Wayne's basement. It's
much bigger basement.
Yeah.
Much longer run for the waiters to come up the stairs. Ugh,
yeah. One full city block, kitchen to dining room, yeah, versus the kitchen being in the dining room in Boston.
So if you want to work out, work at Toro in New York.
I always say, if you want to be a food runner, you get a free Stairmaster. You go, where's the Stairmaster? I go, you'll see at the end of your first shift.
So do you miss Boston? Are you in New York a lot? Where do you find yourself most often?
On the Amtrak in Connecticut.
You should just open up the bar cars on Amtrak. Just redo all that for them.
I would love to do like some sort of guest chef dinner on an Amtrak Acela from Boston to New York.
Let's put that out there in the ether right now. That's going to happen next year.
That'd be rad. I spend a lot of time in New York just because it's really new, and my teams in Boston have been running the restaurants for so long with us that I don't have much to worry about. When I do have something to worry about, they handle it. Like, they're like, hey, this broke, but this is how we fixed it. And instead of like, hey, this is about to break, what do we do? Like, they're so awesome back up in Boston. I do get homesick. I've been going home a lot more often now, and I'm trying to find a balance where I can be 50-50 in both places.
You just need, pneumatic tube systems? Is that what they're called? Just like in that movie Brazil, they just shoot you back and forth. But, you know,
I was actually just looking for the toaster oven from the Time Bandits.
Yes. Another great reference. Man, you just own like 80s to 90s trivia. It's kind of amazing. I wanted to ask you a little trivia question. It's not even a trivia question. It's more of an interpretation. Because you tell me that, you know, Bad Brains is one of your favorite bands. Gorilla Biscuits, close second, if not a mortal tie. Using those as influence, whether it's name or their music, what dish would you make for either band?
Well, I have a lot of respect for both bands, and I have a lot of respect for Gorilla Biscuits, and one of the things that they preach about, not preach about, but, you know, talk about a lot is vegetarianism and not eating their friends and whatnot. So I would have to say I would definitely do something flavorful and vegetarian if I was going to do a Gorilla Biscuits thing. But I'm not sure where I would go with that. For the Bad Brains, I would probably just do something funny with, like, veal brains and make it awkward and awful and delicious. I don't know.
Let's do one more thing about awful. You know, I too am a big fan and proponent of, you know, eating the whole animal. And when you say whole animal, it's not just steak. It's not just skeletal. It's everything inside and in between. What, you know, sweetbreads are a gateway. Liver's a gateway. What have you been able to introduce to Boston, New York, yourself, that you still don't see on menus that you really hope start showing up?
Cod tripe. The cod stomach. We have a stew with cod stomach and octopus heads with spetzel. It's done like kind of a Suquette style, like Barcelona, Romesco, tomato kind of base thing. And the texture of cod stomach cooked down, it's like gelatinous and gummy and chewy and velvety all at once. Kind of reminds me of cocochas, like the hake chins that you'd get in San Sebastian. I love that.
Yeah, and again, this is a very big question. Why is it that wherever you travel in the world, pretty much, there is offal, and yet there's so little in the U.S.?
I don't think that there is little in the U.S. I just think that when you get to more affluent places, the people who could afford to not have to eat the things that were not the best got used to that. So when you go to, like, a rural place in New Orleans and people are still eating nutria, you know, it's a swamp rat, and it's delicious, you know? But somebody, if you try to sell that to somebody in Minneapolis, they might not get it. And I think it's just all, it's all like, you know, where you're from. If you go somewhere that's thick with, you know, Polish heritage, you'll see people eating lots of lard and things like that. And you go to Chinatown, you'll see lots of offal. No matter where the little Chinatowns are in the country, there's always something like that. So I don't know. I just think that you don't see it as much in the nice restaurants anymore because people want to cater to the guests that are coming in. It's hard. You have people coming in to spend money. You want to cater to what they want, not tell them what you want to cook. That's why it's great to have a restaurant like Toro or Copa where we have such a big menu where I can put half the menu of things that people want to eat. People want to eat margarita pizzas and chicken sausage and slow-cooked broccoli and pasta. But I can also put on tripe, and I can also put on a pig's ear salad, and I can put on lamb tartare. That might be a little bit more challenging for guests, but if you build their trust with known things, and people go, their meatballs are so delicious, their arancini is great, and they know how to cut bought prosciutto, they're more likely to say, well, we're going to take a risk, and we're going to try the beef art today. And if that's good, then maybe they'll keep going and keep going and keep going.
Believe me, it's no risk, and you've done such a fine job of having a, you know, fine restaurant with these lower inexpensive cuts and blended it seamlessly. You know, monkfish cheeks with Moroccan spices blew my mind. So keep doing what you're doing. I'll keep following you wherever you go. And thank you for so much being on.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.